You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
For me, it's quite a pleasure because I'm going to test with you my first time some ideas. Ideas that are basically not easy ones and are supposed, or I hope, that they could be helpful to challenge the flaws and the main problems of the global food system. That's basically the four main points of my presentation. First, I will go quickly through specific issues, failures, drawbacks, flaws, etc., of the global food system. Many of you will be pretty much aware of those, so I will just pass by. It's not the main core of my presentation. Then I will stop a bit on three approaches to food, basically food and nutrition security, the right to food, and food sovereignty, and how do they consider food as a private good or as a common good. And then the five dimensions of food, that food is not just a commodity, and also, well, it's also a human right, and you will see later on. But also, according to my hypothesis, is food also should be considered a common good for the humankind. And if we agree, or if I'm capable of demonstrating that idea, I think that the political and legal implications of food as a commons are enormous. And those implications could help in this transition towards sustainable food systems. I will briefly provide some developments of the right to food in Latin America, an area where I've been working in the last 6 years, basically on food and nutrition security and right to food, and I was personally involved in some of those developments. So I will briefly present how Latin America is at the forefront of the right to food in the world. And finally, I will explain a bit more why I consider that food could be considered a common, different elements or food-related elements of food, and finally, the tricentric approach to food that is not yet developed, is just suggesting. Well, that's an oxymoron. It's evident, and it shouldn't be highlighted that much, but it's relevant to my presentation that we as human beings pretty much depend on four things. Sunlight, we need it to metabolize, vitamins, etc. But basically, we need three issues every day, every human being. Air, to get oxygen for our blood, for our cells. Food, to get the calories and adenosine triphosphate that metabolize, etc. And water in order to dehydrate our body, because our human bodies are compounded by 75% of water. That's evident, okay? But only food is considered so far a private good. Air is a common, officially, let's say, understood or approved by everybody. Air is all over the world, it's free, everybody can breathe without pain, up to now. Water, it used to be a common good up to mid 20th century, and right now we are in a very fast process of privatization of that good, but still in many areas you can go anywhere and you can drink in any river, anywhere. So in principle, water for most of our written history was considered a common good. And right now, it's nice to compare air, food, and water, because food is totally privatized, basically for the global food system or the dominant food system is totally privatized. Water is in the process, and air is not yet privatized. But I'm pretty sure that within 50 years, even earlier, considering the pollution and the amount of people that we are breathing and the ozone layer depletion, etc., up to a certain point, we'll have to pay a tax for breath. And that's our home, okay? Our home with the planet boundaries. Some of those boundaries, we are living there, and there is no other Earth, or there is no other place. So we have to learn how to live within those boundaries. We, according to Rockstrom, they have published in Nature, we have already surpassed, we as a human society, three out of 9 planetary boundaries: biodiversity extinction, phosphorus depletion, and climate change. And now what about food? As I said, quickly going through this. What about food and hunger? Well, we are doing well according to latest FAO figures. We are decreasing from 1 billion in the 90s to 868 million hungry people. And you can see there is another line where you can see how is situation in Latin America, because I will talk about Latin America later on. So the world is doing well according to the MDGs and according to, let's say, those general figures. But you can see there is a poster from China. That's basically thanks to China. China has been doing an impressive progress in the reduction of hunger. And China is a huge country that has contributed a lot to this absolute decrease. But the rest of the world, Africa, Southeast Asia, North Africa, and developed countries are not doing that well. Actually, the number of absolute figure of hungry people have increased since the 90s. So every year we have more hungry people in the world if China is apart. And in addition to hunger, we have another imbalance of the global food system. The global food system is not fulfilling its mandate. That would be filling everybody adequately and sustainably with the current, with the resources that we have on Earth. We produce enough food, but we have more than 2 billion people that are malnourished. Malnourished by excess, malnourished by defect. We have we eat badly in general, and we have not just the hungry people, but something like 1.4 billion overweight people and 300 millions of obese people. And obesity, overweight, and hunger, they cause more than 5 million deaths annually. So basically, basically, hunger is the highest death cause for children in the world. Around one-third of all child deaths can be attributed to hunger-related diseases. And that's a slide that I always put for everybody, because what does hunger mean? Basically, hunger means that brains will not develop as they should be. And this type of, you can see there is a malnourished brain, that is the sponge, is pretty much skewed, whereas a well-nourished child has a very well-developed brain. So people will be less happy, less active, less innovative, less everything, because there is less brain cell connections, synaptic connections, and that is irreversible. If you don't eat well the first 3 years, forget it. I mean, then it will never be recovered. So those are both the problems that we have, because the global food system is not working well. Okay, that's one of the key messages. It's not just because we don't produce. We produce enough, but we waste a lot. You know, between one-third and one-half of the total food produced in the world is wasted. With the water that has been used, with the soils that have been used, with the phosphorus that has been used to produce that water. And another interesting point is that the food industry is the second biggest in the world. So that's a political issue. It's an important issue. And after the oil industry, the food industry is the second biggest in the world. So when we're dealing with food, it's not just a minor issue. You know, politics is about geopolitics, it's about oil, it's about war. No, geopolitics is also about food. And you can see that there is a high concentration of food industry, and more there are oligopolies that are controlling a huge share of the food that we eat. And many of you may remember that adagio, or that statement said by Henry Kissinger, that if you control oil, you control the countries, but if you control food, you control the people. Basically, that's what they are doing. They are trying to control us by controlling the food that we eat. So we need a drastic change, okay? And a drastic change is not the type of changes that are so far proposed. There are some, like the UK government with the Future of Food and Farming report and the AASTD, famous report, Agriculture at the Crossroads. Both of them are really advocating for a drastic change. And a drastic change, from my point of view, and that's the type of research that I will be doing the next years, is that we need to approach hunger from a different perspective. Food. Food cannot be seen or regarded as a pure commodity issue. Because food has many other dimensions, and one of those, basically the least developed, is food as a common. Planet boundaries, climate change, oil peak, all those are mega trends that will force us to produce food and to eat food in a different way. So the analytical framework, food dimensions and the approaches to food, two important issues that I would like to raise with you. There are five, well, I've seen that there are five dimensions of food. The first one is the human need. The second one is food is part of our culture. The way that we produce food and the way that we eat food is a cultural issue. So then lately, since the mid-20th century, since the International Covenant of Economic and Social Human Rights and the Human Rights Charter, food is also considered a human right, more and more developed. So far, not as developed as civil and political rights, but it's gaining momentum. Food is definitely a commodity. Since the very early ages when we were producing food and we were selling food to urban dwellers or we were selling food to other countries, etc. And food is also a commons. And this dimension has not yet been developed, barely touched by the commoners, that is those type of researchers and activists that they are defending the commons. And that's the dimension that I would like to further explore. And that's basically the key elements or the hypothesis of my research, is that I think, and I will try to demonstrate, that the post-industrial food civic actors, what means examples such as the slow food movement or food commons movement in California, or Le Groupe Alimentaire in Belgium, or similar groups in Europe, they share the same consideration with customary food civic actions, like indigenous groups and the way that they approach it to communal territories, etc. They share the same consideration of food as a common. Food not just a commodity. Of course, it's a commodity. I'm not denying that, but not just a commodity. And both groups in, let's say, the global south and developed countries, both groups are in opposition to the consideration of the globalized industrial food system that only considers food as a commodity. So now we'll go to the three paradigms: food security, right to food, and food sovereignty. Well, food and nutrition security, the way that is now termed, they haven't already inserted the nutrition in the definition, is a very technical, technocratic, and it's also the dominant approach to food issues in the world. And in that sense, that's the FAO General Assembly, access is the main issue so far. Although we know that we have to increase production by 2050 in order to feed the 9 billion people that is expected, so far we produce enough food for everybody, in theory. The problem is that people are not rich enough, they don't have enough money to access that food. So access is the main issue, because if you don't have money, you don't eat. What means that food is totally regarded as a pure private good. You eat as long as you pay, or you eat as long as you have enough money to purchase fertilizers, chemicals, and land to produce yourself. If not, you don't eat. And there is a paper that it will be posted there. And at the beginning, there is a quotation of St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians. Don't you remember the rule we had when we live with you? If you don't work, you don't eat. It's written in the Bible. Then, the second paradigm is the second approach to food is the legal approach. The first one was the technical. The second one is the legal approach, the right to food. Right to food that is enshrined in the International Covenant of Economic and Social and Cultural Rights is justiciable, but means that you can demand that this right is not fulfilled. States must respect, fulfill, protect. We as citizens, we can claim that this right has not been fulfilled. All the and the states, they have the obligation, the duty to help us to produce or to help us to access and to help us to get directly the food. But as a legal approach, it doesn't contest pretty much the proprietary rights of food. So basically, food is still perceived as a private good. Proprietary rights are basically the sacred pillar of capitalism. Profit accumulation, proprietary rights, and that the Darwinian approach to development. And the right to food, you will see that is in Latin America is progressing, but in the rest of the world, it's not progressing that much. Although this right is fully equivalent to the right to freedom of speech or the right not to be tortured. Those rights that are pretty much developing in most of the world, but it's not exactly the same for the right to food. So now we go to a very short parenthesis on how this right to food has been developed in Latin America. You can see all the food security laws that they have been issued since 2005 in 7 countries. And that means that in those countries, the fight against hunger and the right to adequate food, they are already enshrined in the legal framework. In many countries, even enshrined in the constitution. And that provides the main pillar for anti-hunger programs, policies, etc. And apart of those 7 countries that they have already issued and approved a law, you have 7 other 10 countries where there are drafts that are already under discussion in the parliament. You have an active civil society that is demanding and producing reports. You have ombudsmans, procuradurías, where people, more and more people, more and more lawyers and human rights activists are demanding this right. And you have constitutional amendments that they have already been issued and approved, and some amendments that are ongoing. So right now, Latin America is pointing out the way ahead for the right to food in the world. The problem is that, I usually say that it's basically a question of language. I mean, they need to write more things in English in order to enable the Africans and the Asians to know what they are doing. And we have here an example of my friend Carlos Escobedo that is coming from Guatemala. Guatemala is one of those countries that has already issued food security law and is also doing notably progress on the fight against hunger. And now the third paradigm, food sovereignty. Well, food sovereignty is a relatively new concept, but it's quickly evolving. It's a civil society proposal, and I think that is so far the best developed alternative to the dominant food system, so far. Initially, it went from the barricades. They were just claiming against everything. They were demonstrating. They were criticizing. But since 1996, that is quite close, they have really developed to this present stage where they are already a serious alternative, a threatening alternative for the establishment. There are already many countries that have adopted the food sovereignty approach: Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Honduras, most of them in Latin America, but there are now countries like Mali that is already, let's say, following the line. It's still a work in progress. So the food sovereignty foundations and the claims and the main rationale and the elements are not already engraved. They are not quite fixed. They are evolving because there are many civil society groups that are thinking about that. And unfortunately, and that's a challenge that I launch here, not that much support from the academia or the think tanks. And not that much support from the UN system. For the UN system, as far as I know, it's still a frightening world. cannot be written in the official document. Many member states are not pleased with that. So, but it will change. It will change. Because I think that, frankly speaking, from my personal point of view, it's so far the only alternative to the flow, let's say, the non-functional global food system. And one of the key issues of food sovereignty is that producers and consumers are the core group that should control and dominate, well, should dominate is not a good word, should control the food system, and not the intermediaries, not the companies, not the retailers, not the transnational companies that are basically more and more dominating the seed market, the agrochemicals market, and even the retailing market. And one of the claims of the food sovereignty movement is that food is not a commodity. As far as I read, they haven't yet said that food is a common. But at least they are saying the first, and they are already defending the first part, that food is not a commodity. And it's not a commodity like screws, as you can see there. And therefore, food should be out of WTO debates. Because WTO is basically dealing with commodities. So there should be another legal framework, another international legal framework where food should be dealt with. And now going briefly to two features of private and public goods. Private goods are those that are excludable and rival. Rival, what means that the property of the good, rival means that if I eat something, if I eat a peach, if I sip a water, you cannot eat the same peach, neither the same water. So food, from that point of view, that is very much an economic approach to private common goods, food is a private good. And then excludability means that once I produce something, I can limit the property of a good whereby a person can be prevented from using it. So I can limit who is going to access that good produced. Food, if I cultivate food and I produce a peach, I can prevent all of you of accessing to that peach. Either because, you have to pay for that, so if I put a very high price, nobody will be able to access it, or because it's my peach. So, I can decide who has access to that. But that's, the approach to private and common goods from the economic point of view. There is also, and it's already presented in the paper, there is a political approach that is not that much determined by excludability and rivalry, because excludability and rivalry are not inherent properties of goods. They are social constructs. It depends on what the society decides in each moment of time. Many common goods have been privatized, they have been enclosed, as we have seen for water and for food, depending on what human society decides. Not all human societies, not all cultures, not all countries, they have the same considerations for the same things. So you can see in red different food-related elements and how those food-related elements are included in the different boxes. I will elaborate a bit more later on because I have a specific slide for that. But basically, so far, cultivated food, it's a pure private good. I have still, or I have already gone? Okay. So, now, deconstructing food-related elements, just to see if they are private or if they are public or common goods. Cultivated food is a private good. Okay, fine, it's produced in private lands. You have to purchase the seeds, certified seeds. You have to purchase the agrochemicals, and the land, in many cases, needs to be yours. So basically, the final product is yours. It's a private good. But traditional agricultural knowledge, everybody agrees that it's a public good. It's a common. Nobody owns. Nobody has a specific copyright of traditional agricultural knowledge that is still feeding us pretty much. So basically, we have still more than, I don't know, 60% of the food produced in the world is produced by small farmers. Most of them producing food based on traditional agricultural knowledge. But also, modern agricultural knowledge produced by public institutions is officially considered a public good. Cuisine, recipes, gastronomy is definitely a public good. Famous chefs like Ferran Adrià, they constructed omelette. Ferran Adrià, that probably you will know, that is a famous Spanish chef. He is not afraid of sharing his receipts with the rest of the world. I mean, because the receipts is an open source knowledge, as well as the what happens in the fashion world. I mean, designers, fashion designers for clothes, etc. Most of them, they don't copyright their designs, and either in the cooking arena or in the fashion arena, innovation is still a very much driving force. So there is a lot of innovation. Having no patents does not prevent innovation in those areas, as is basically claimed by transnational corporations in the agricultural domain. Edible wild plants and animals. I mean, we can go to the forest and pick up mushrooms or asparagus, or we can go anywhere fishing. In some cases, it's partially privatized because we need to pay license. But who is the owner of that mushroom? It's everybody's. Genetic resources for food and agriculture also consider either national public goods or international public goods for those crops that are already included in the International Treaty of Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. The Codex Alimentarius and food safety considerations is in everybody's interest. So that knowledge, those legal frameworks, are also public goods. Good nutrition and public health is still, because we are also in the process of privatizing all public health, but it's still considered a public good. Because if everybody eats well and you don't have overweight and you don't have hungry people, the public health system would spend less. So it's in everybody's benefit. And extreme food price fluctuations. Nobody, except the brokers that are earning money out of this, neither the producers nor the customers, we don't have any interest in have extreme food price fluctuations. Martin Wolf, one of the main writers in The Economist, was the guy that was pointing out to extreme market fluctuations in general. So I have applied the same rationale to food commodities. So what if food is considered common? What would be the implications? And I have just suggested some ideas in the paper, because that's the part that is not yet developed. I don't want to present blueprint solutions. And of course, I need a lot of time, or will need, because that's also a common issue, we'll need more time to develop the implications should this approach be better considered. For instance, considering that food is not just a private commodity or a private good, but it's also a common. Well, we should ban future trade speculation, because they are dealing with something that is a key essential for human beings. They are not dealing with screws, with books, or with glasses. They are dealing with food. We should issue more controlling legal frameworks for or preventing or really controlling strictly land grabbing, water grabbing, land evictions. We need to issue more legal frameworks supporting and, let's say, promoting collective rights, avoiding biopiracy, minimizing copyrighted agriculture, because copyrighted agriculture is not benefiting all human beings, and is not even good for innovation. And of course, combating and let's say with all our strengths the oligopolies that are growing every year, trying to control as much food as we consume. And finally, proposal that I'm presenting in the document, and it's basically based on Eleanor Ostrom's work. She has presented those ideas for natural resources, so I've used the same rationale to be focused on food and food producing systems. And the polycentric, in that case, tree-centric approach to food systems, I think that could be the foundationals or the rationale for this drastic change the global food system needs. Because if we keep on considering food as a commodity, and we focus all our efforts in increasing production and maximizing food access because we need to provide people money to purchase the food, I think that things are not going to be much better. And, well, the concentration will keep on. And at the end, our society will not be well off. And the social welfare will diminish. And at the end, the global food system will not fulfill its mandate. Feeding everybody well, sustainably. So what's the tree-centric approach? The tree-centric approach is basically that, well, private sector will market some excedents, and there will be a place for the private sector, of course, as well as for governmental regulations and the role of the state. Both things are already quite solid and consistent right now. But we need to facilitate to open up more space for collective actions. Actions that already stem from people's motivations. They want to do things, and actually they do things. There are many initiatives worldwide that are rising up, things that are cooking up, and there is a lot of activity, a lot of groups that they have seen that the current food system is not fulfilling their aspirations, and they want to do something else. They have specific motivations. We don't produce food just because we can sell the food. We produce food because it's a cultural issue. I love gardening. Well, I don't love gardening, but I could have loved gardening. And it's not just because I produce flowers, and then I can sell the flowers, or I can sell the potatoes. It's because I really love doing those things. For the Mayans in Central America, where I've been working for quite a while, cropping maize is their root. It's not just cropping maize because then they will eat the maize and for them it's a staple food. It's because it's their people of maize. Then you have socioeconomic and you have motivations. You need specific institutions and institutional regimes and legal regimes that those regimes support the collective actions, because so far the legal regimes are meant for the private sector. And it's basically those legal regimes are coming from the state, from governmental control. But also another pillar of this collective action group is the ethics, the foundation, the ethical foundation of what we are producing food. The private sector produces food to maximize the profit, to earn money. They don't produce food to feed us or, to give us better health. They produce food because it's a commodity. So the more I produce, the more I sell, the bigger the profit. Ethics and the ethical foundations of the global food system, they need to be revisited. It's a very nice word in the UN system. And they need to be strengthened. We need to raise the ethical foundations of the global food system in order to decommodify and recommodify food. Those are very nice words, but difficult to pronounce. But the idea is that so far, most of the food we eat, not all, but most of the food we eat is a pure commodity. So we need to think about food. We need to see food in a different way. Food is true. It's partially one dimension of food is a commodity, but not only that. It's just the final one. So the way we approach food will pretty much determine the shape of the global food system in the future. If we approach food as a commodity, we'll have more of the same. If we change our perception of the perception that we have of food, and we design or redesign the system according to that new dimension, I'm pretty sure that we'll do a different and more sustainable global food system for all of us. And that's it. Food is a common, yes. And food is also a human right, yes. Food is a commodity, yes. Food is a need, of course. And what's the last one? I already forgot. But thank you very much for your interest. Thank you very much for stealing your time to the lunch break for being here. We are also talking about food, but not yet eating food. So.
Well, thank you, José Luis, for an extremely interesting presentation. I think his presentation and the paper, which, as he mentioned, I think will be available on the UNRIS website after this event, they both constitute an extremely positive contribution to the debate on food, and a reminder of what really should be considered the shame of that so much hunger and malnutrition exists in the world despite relative wealth in other parts of the planet. And as well, it contributes some important new thinking, which is this kind of thinking that is going to be essential to challenging the shortage of food, the lack of access to food for certain parts of the population. And it's particularly relevant at this point in time, given what we've seen in the last few years of the food price shocks and rising interest in foreign agriculture investment, described by critics as a land grab, and in particular the role that speculation has played in that. What I want to do as a discussant is to raise a few questions around the issue of food, and in particular to try and set the debate on food and hunger within a broader developmental context, which is the usual focus of UNRWA's own work, and also drawing on my own research on social policy and agrarian political economy. And in by doing so, I'm hoping that I can sort of provoke a debate when you get your chance to ask your questions in a few minutes, and also as a constructive engagement to try and push José Luis a little further. I'll try and be brief so that to give you as much time as possible to ask your own questions. The first question I want to raise is, to what extent, by focusing specifically on food and hunger, is there a danger that we neglect the broader role of food production and of agricultural production in socioeconomic development? And a common theme of UNRWA's own research in recent years has been to question the focus on poverty reduction within the development industry. Essentially arguing that by narrowly focusing on poverty, you end up with targeted residual policies which fail to address the structural problems that surround the production of poverty. And instead, UNRWA has argued for an approach which combines social policy and economic policy in a more mutually constitutive approach, and that has historically been a much better way of addressing poverty reduction. So there's a question here: is there a parallel between poverty and hunger? And is hunger most likely to be addressed through specific legislation and specific targeted policies, or is it more likely to be addressed through a much broader socioeconomic development strategy? To follow that up, and perhaps an example would help. Certainly, research on the early stages of industrialization and agrarian transformation in Taiwan and South Korea noted that an increased agricultural production of food by smallholder farmers was a key input into industrialization in those countries, since it lowered the living wage for urban workers and the competitiveness of industry. Nevertheless, these increases in agricultural production were achieved by an authoritarian state which improved agricultural inputs on smallholder farmers, including, you know, the police going around and destroying crops which weren't using improved seeds, forcing farmers to adopt improved seeds and fertilizers. And indeed, through surplus extraction by unfair terms of trade in bartering with fertilizer, and in many ways exploiting the smallholder farmers for the benefit of, as the government saw it, as the whole country. And in those countries, both poverty and hunger were ultimately reduced through a process of structural transformation of the economy and the generation of employment, rather than specific targeted social protection programs. And Jorge Luis mentioned China earlier in his presentation. I suspect a similar account is probably true in China as well. And indeed, at present, a number of African countries, in slightly different ways, have drawn on the East Asian model and in different variants of it to influence their own policies and around agricultural production. So my question is, would this development strategy have been possible under a food sovereignty approach, or if food was conceptualized as a commons? And my own feeling is that probably it wouldn't. But then, as a follow-up question, how do you weigh the exploitation of smallholders, which evidently happened in many of those countries, against the social, economic, and ultimately political benefits that transpired for subsequent generations? The second point relates to how to actually operationalize this concept of food as a commons or the right to food. And potentially there's a tension here between interventions related to the supply side of how do you transform agricultural production away from this notion of food as a commodity to transforming both the production of food and the distribution of food to promote a more sustainable and equitable food production system. And I think I take his point very well that it's perhaps fantasy to provide a blueprint, but I still think it's worth thinking through some of the implications of what does it really mean what does a sustainable and equitable food production system actually, you know, start to think through what it looks like. The other possible approach is to deal more with the supply of food and guaranteeing the right to food and access to food for people through social protection policies of various different types. And José Luis in his paper makes some suggestions of ways that states might start to do that. But to pose a question here, there's the agrarian studies literature highlights a common challenge for states of how to balance the concerns of producers who require incentives and, generally speaking, high prices to increase production versus consumers who, primarily urban-based, who require low prices to ensure widespread access to food. So, plausibly, there's a situation here where to guarantee the right to food, governments can intervene, and the best way for them to do that may be to import cheap grain from abroad, dump it on local markets, and thereby damaging local producers. And there's a question here of the trade-offs of how governments actually go about operationalizing this concept of the right to food and how to satisfy different interest groups within a country. The final point that I wanted to raise was to do with how do you mobilise politically to address some of these issues. What José Luis is proposing, the outlines of it, is quite a radical rethink of the food production system and global capitalism. So what political grouping, constituency, is going to be able to mobilise to promote these changes? And this is particularly relevant with respect to the challenge of not only achieving change at a global or national level in terms of legislation and treaties, but actually pursuing that change right down to the grassroots and making sure that it's actually implemented. A common problem both with the Declaration on Human Rights, which recognises the right to food, and some of the legislation that José Luis mentioned in Latin America has been that formal commitments at national or global level haven't really been matched by much action on the ground. In terms of constituencies that are going to mobilise to make these changes actually happen via Campesino is perhaps the most promising outlook at the moment. But as an international peasant movement, are smallholder farmers really a sufficiently powerful political actor to be able to confront the entrenched interests of global capitalism? And how would you go about building a wider political constituency? And then the final point I wanted to make was that in many of the countries where food insecurity is the biggest problem, I did conducting much of my research in Ethiopia, which has a major food insecurity problem. Democratic institutions and any kind of discussion about rights of any sort, let alone the right to food, is virtually non-existent. So, and indeed is frequently seen as a direct challenge to state authority. And so it's not just that they don't exist, it's that they are actively suppressed. So in that context, to consider the right to food, to consider food as a commons, to what extent does that, the mobilisation for those purposes, have to be subsumed within a broader process of democratisation? Okay, so that's my comments. I will now sit down and resume my role as chair. The intention of those comments was to sort of open up issues, but I'm sure you all have comments, questions of your own, so I will leave José Luis to decide as and when he feels ready, if he wants to address any of those points on or leave them aside. But I'll open the floor up for questions and take maybe three or four together,
can,
and then you
can
respond
open up
directly
the floor
to those.
And I've already taken some notes of your comments. We could have another hour and a half.
These are big issues.
Considering that people have been skipping the lunch just for being here, I think that it could be also good to see your reactions. I've already taken note of yours.
Sure.
But I think that we can open up.
Are there any questions? Okay. Peter, first of all.
Peter Rapin from UNRIS. Thanks for a fascinating talk. Great. Towards the end, you pointed out a few of the possible policy implications of what you laid out. And I was thinking that they seemed a bit, given the breadth of what you had presented earlier, the policy implications seemed a bit restricted, in the sense that I think you focused on the point about bans on trade and speculation, regulations on land grabbing and other aspects, and the issue of oligopolies and concentration. But what I didn't see there was what seemed to be fundamental features of the whole concept of food sovereignty, as it was promoted by Via Campesina. So the emphasis on... So my question, what would the policy implications of this commons approach be in terms of promotion of local development, local production, agroecology, small producer empowerment, which seem to be key aspects of the food sovereignty concept?
Are there any other? Yes, could I ask everyone to just introduce themselves quickly before they ask the question? But yes, go ahead.
Olivier Deschutier, UN Special Rapporteur on Ready to Food. Let me begin with just one example of where food was treated as a common, which is in primitive societies, when it was the product of the group and everything that was produced was shared, so that even if these societies were extremely poor, nobody was led to starve as a result of land grabbing. And there's, Stone Age Economics by Marshall Salins is describing this in very vivid terms. Carl Polanyi also did some work on those societies. Now, what made that possible was a very strong solidarity within the group, the absence of any divisions, and the closeness, essentially, of different members, leading them to be in solidarity with one another and willing to share, basically. in societies that are more complex and organized across larger populations, that kind of solidarity is very difficult to establish, except by the state, which is meant to embody the public interest. But as you pointed out, in many cases, the state has been not delivering for the benefit of the population, has been captured by some groups, and is often mistrusted. And so the question is, if food is really to be treated as a commons, because it's not like sunlight and water and air that are not to be processed, it has to be processed, it has to be distributed, it has to be taken care of by some body. The only body I see is the state, because the group by itself is too diverse and disorganized to provide this for the benefit of its members. And so my question is really whether the political consequences of this are adequately measured. I mean by this that if you have one state, one government controlling the distribution of food to ensure that all children, all families have enough food, and for example paying the producers so that they produce like wage workers producing this which is treated as a commons then for distribution purposes, is this not giving huge power to the state and making it extremely both difficult to organize and politically sensitive or risky to do so?
Okay, thank you. Are there any others at the moment? Yes, please, in the back.
My name is Aisha, and I have a question on the author, actually common question actually on the operationalization.
Okay.
So here I was wondering on the precentric approach of the civic organizations, I was wondering how this can be included, like how can civil society will be involved in this way of making people believe, to think that food is a common good. But I think that here we all know that it's a common good. We want to believe that it's a common good. It's not something like economy has to take for itself. And I also want to believe that for most peasants working on the ground and trying to eat, the food is a right, and eating is a right, and, well, it's just normal. So the core issue here is the private societies and the governments. So, and I think that one of the major organizations that can work on that, and they have been proven really efficient on other rights, for example, I don't know, death penalty and all, like civil and society, political rights. So if they can be involved in getting something done on this type of issues, I think that it can be more efficient than staying in the theoretical aspect. So that's why I say it's just a comment and a question, and as I was not here in the beginning, I don't know if this has already been discussed. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think you've probably got enough to be getting on with for now, so we can come back for another round after.
Okay. Well, I think I will focus my intervention now in how to, because I've seen that several questions are pretty much related to how to operationalize and how to render this theoretical idea concrete policy or programs, etc. But first of all, your last point, you cannot imagine how, well, there is almost nothing on food as a common in the web. I mean, I was really surprised. You know, I was looking for, you know, these typical papers, even from Via Campesina or any one of those leftish academicians, almost nothing. I mean, I've been doing something like 2 or 3 weeks research, trying to find out, surfing in the web, putting different keywords, trying to find papers dealing with the idea of food as a common, and almost nothing. There is something that was published in Ryerson in Canada by a Brazilian lady, but touching slightly the issue. Via Campesina is claiming that food is not a commodity, but it's not so often seen that it's a common. because we are still pretty much indoctrinated that food is a private good. Then going to, that's why, I mean, I really like, what's her name? Removing the paddle, or removing the, you know, when you have a pond, a lake, and then you remove the water. I mean, because while I've been working on food security issues from the managerial point of view for quite a while, and now being at the university, for me, it's a nice opportunity to think outside the box. You know, I've been thinking inside the box. I've been working for the UN, for the European Commission, for NGOs, and always you have to think in practical issues. So now it's my time to think a bit how things could be done differently. What about implications? How to operationalize? Well, in principle, it could be good to establish some parallelism between, for instance, public food and public health. I mean, we don't have. I mean, we see something. You know, we are puzzled by the fact that the state should provide food to everybody, at least a minimum level. But everybody is quite pleased and comfortable with the state providing health, public health, for everybody, as we do in Europe. So public health is basically state provided, and we are quite happy with that. Actually, we are quite proud. That in my case, the Spanish government has universal health coverage for everybody. But why not food? Because food is as equal as health, is essential for our survival. But, you know, having the government providing a minimum amount of food, equal to, for instance, the national food basket, to everybody, if they cannot afford, well, we see that that's an abomination, you know? It's strange. It's because we are really within our framework. Then how things could be operationalized? I've already mentioned, and it's already there is a nice sentence in my paper that I don't expect to see the outputs of this paper during my lifespan, but I hope that my grandchildren will. Because, I mean, it has been 10,000 years of privatization of food, and it's not going to be me who is going to reverse the situation. Because, there are also many implications, as Olivier has raised, that, food is not exactly as air and water. Because we can produce food, but we cannot produce water. We can just make it potable, drinkable, but not produce water. And air is all over around. But, how to do things? My idea is that the transition towards a different food system would take a long way. But we could open up new spaces for collective action. And in that sense, the state has an important role to play by enabling legal frameworks that provide legal areas for collective actions to grow. I mean, you know, not restricting, for instance, an example, seeds. Right now in Europe, there is a very strict seed legislation that prevents farmers to sell non-certified seeds. And you know that pretty well. So if we open up the space, if we loosen the legal regulations, we enable those collective groups that are producing seeds to exchange seeds. Now it's even forbidden to exchange seeds that are not certified. So that's an example, subsidizing this type of collective groups. Instead of subsidizing oil, you know, is the highest commodity subsidized in the world, instead of subsidizing oil to be sold as a private good, we can subsidize a bit those collective actions. And the idea is that it's not yet developed, and I don't have clear ideas, I don't have clear explanations, but the idea is that instead of having two sectors, the public domain and the private sector dealing with food, we should actually, we should enable a third vortex of the pyramid to develop collective actions, like the slow food movement. In California, you can see, there is in the web, there is the foodcommons.org. So they have already organized themselves outside the state and outside the market in order to provide food for the community. And it's true that this type of developments can basically, so far, only be done at the community level. But if you have thousands of communities doing similar things, at the end, you have a different food system. But in that case, initially, in the first period, you need to have the state to guarantee a minimum amount of everybody. And we can link this idea to practical UN-sponsored actions such as the social floor. What is the social floor? Where is the floor? Well, the floor should be established or should be determined by the national food basket, because the national food basket is the minimum amount of food that enable us to keep on living. So, I mean, the minimum threshold is not negotiated. I mean, it shouldn't be negotiated because, and that's why I'm addressing one of your concerns, because poverty is a relative term, whereas food or hunger is an absolute one because it's determined by our body. 2,200 kilocalories per person per day as average. I mean, here, if I have $5, I'm poor. $5 in a day in Geneva, I can't buy anything. If I have $5 in Haiti, I can survive 3 days. So, I mean, poverty is a relative concept. That's why I prefer food, because I mean, you have 868 million hungry people, and you have 1.4 billion extremely poor people. So poverty, extreme poverty, is not exactly hunger. That's one of the explanations. Another issue that, basic income, that is another, let's say, practical element that has been developed by Philippe Bamparis, another professor from the university, the Catholic University of Leuven. The minimum basic income, well, it's always either determined by charity, by negotiation, or by humanitarian considerations. But, well, one of the implications of considering food as a common is that it should be determined by the national food basket. Because in each country it's a different one, but it's the minimum amount of food that enable a full family to eat normally or poorly, but enough, every month. This idea of having the minimum wage. The minimum wage that is basically a negotiation between trade unions and the government, or the trade unions and the patrons. Well, where is the minimum? The minimum should be determined by the national food basket. And it's not like this. I mean, I've been working in Central America, and out of Costa Rica, no country has a minimum wage that equals, at least, if not exceeds, equals the national food basket. So, if you remember our Catholic backgrounds, we were punished by, the Adam and Eva, they were in the paradise, and we were punished to earn our food with the sweat of our forehead or something like this. Well, even if you work, 14 hours per day during 7 days, you don't earn enough money to feed your family and to eat. And that's really a shame.
Okay, should we go back for another round? You first and then Il-Chung afterwards.
Thank you. My name is Linda Mani from the Standing Committee on Nutrition based here in Geneva. First of all, thank you very much to Jose Luis for a very interesting presentation. And I must say, I felt a bit frustrated. 2 weeks ago, our organization, the Standing Committee on Nutrition, organized a 4-day meeting on looking at the nutrition impact of food systems. And I think during those 4 days, we had lots of different experts talking both on undernutrition, overnutrition, private sector, and so forth. But the human rights aspect was definitely lacking in our meeting. But indeed, when we talked, we had a presentation from Professor Carlos Montero from Brazil showing really that even in Brazil, where they really achieved a reduction of undernutrition, the obesity is going right up. And in 2 years' time, they will have the same level as in the US if nothing is being done now. So definitely something is wrong. And the role of the private sector there, we had a discussion, and there definitely was not an agreement. Now, my question now to José Luis, I would say one food that is commons and that I thought you might have mentioned is breast milk. And I am wondering, I mean, this is something that is being produced and is so far not sold, although there are competitors and alternatives and substitutes. So I'm thinking, Do you agree that that is a commons, and couldn't we learn from what is happening to breastfeeding? That's my question.
Okay.
Thank you very much for fascinating presentation. And the, my question is rather a theoretical question, because everybody else has dealt with operational question. And my question is related to the latest question, whether breastfeeding is common or not. I mean, the categorization of goods into public, common, club, and private is very much in line with the framework established by neoclassical economics. And I wonder whether those operational strategies and principles are not applicable if we consider food as food, private, or common, or club, or public. My question is very much intentionally provocative. Anyway, I mean, I agree to all the kind of strategies and normative arguments you made, but I think that framework itself, I mean, do we have to consider food, common good, if we want to meet all those basic needs? I mean, you know, even though it is private good, there is a way to meet the needs. And even though it is considered public good by the state, you know, you can starve people. In China, that happened in the 1950s and 60s. In Korea, it was completely private good, but hunger was drastically reduced. So what is the point to think food as common good? I mean, the, you know, if those strategies to meet the needs, to reduce the hunger, are much more important, maybe we have to focus on those strategic methods rather than conceptual methods. That is my question.
Okay.
Perfect.
Any more? There's one more question here.
My name is Jules Berlo. I'm from the Graduate Institute, and I'd like to rebound on this argument because I'd like to have some economic arguments and some economic reasoning on why treating food as a common would give a first best option and more food to people, because we know there are market failures that comes from the fact that goods are commons. For example, when we think about R&D and innovation, we need incentives to perform R&D. And when we think about the Green Revolution in the 60s and in the 70s, it was a very good way to raise the productivity level in developing countries. So why would changing food into a commons would help to address this problem of availability of food? And second, about the strategy of the commons in general, why would we not focus more on poverty reduction and social policies to, in terms of famines, instead of considering food as a commons? And
okay.
Okay. Again, that would give us a nice opportunity to keep on talking for an hour. And I really appreciate your comments, the practical ones and the more theoretical ones, because, well, as I said, it's already out, but at the very end, I would love to keep on exchanging with everybody, and I'm pretty much open to critics and to economic critics, political critics, and let's say theoretical or philosophical critics, because, I don't have the truth. It's just an approach that I would like to test, and I don't have all the answers. In 10 years, I will not have all the answers either. But one by one. About Brazil and breast milk and breastfeeding, I totally agree. I think that breastfeeding should be considered also part of this idea of food as a common. Actually, in the Middle Ages, women, they were feeding other children out of herds. So in principle, they consider that if they produce enough milk for my kid, I can also share this milk with other kids around. And one of the ideas, one of the collateral effects of considering food as a common is that breastfeeding that is basically is naturally produced should be supported, fully supported without any alternatives, etc. The Brazil case is an interesting one because Brazil has already established one of the programs within the Fome Zero is local purchases. So the government is specifically targeting small farmers to purchase and to, let's say, secure their production, because they know that the state will purchase a share or the complete amount of the complete harvest at a fair price. So it's the state who is purchasing directly to the farmers. But it's a nice way, it's one of the aspects of the state guaranteeing a minimum amount of food for people and a minimum amount of income for small farmers. Bolsa Familia is a very known safety net, and you will know those things. Bolsa Familia, it's based on the idea that every Brazilian citizen should eat 3 times per day. And if they don't have enough resources, the state will provide that food or that amount of a minimum amount of money in order to guarantee that. So that's another idea, and for them was the key driving political element. All the social program in Brazil is pretty much focused on securing at least a minimum amount of food for everybody. Regarding the market and the theoretical aspects, I mean, you are right that I could have chosen another framework, theoretical framework, to analyze food. I'm not an economist, I'm an agricultural engineer, and I'm not that extremely familiarized with, the economic approaches to food. But I thought that this one, that is pretty much dominant, it comes from the economic arena, but also has a lot of political implications. And in the paper is developed that the private-public consideration of different goods, it can be approached from the economic side, and there is a lot of papers and doctrines developed on that issue, but can also be approached from the political side, and even from the an everyday citizen's side or point of view. I mean, for a public good is something that is good for everybody. Well, I mean, it can be rival, excludable, but that's the economic approach. And the politicians, they say that that's a social construct. They are not ontologically inherent features of goods. So it's up to us to decide if we consider that food is a private good or impure private good from the economic terms or a public good. It used to be, thousands of years ago, a public good, as Olivier has mentioned. But right now it's not. So it's a social construct. And we can debate about it. I think that we should debate. That's the key. The key issue of this paper is that, hey, we can think differently. I mean, I'm just, I don't know, clear ideas. And regarding your question on the market, why we should not keep our faith in the market? Because basically the market has proven that they cannot feed well everybody right now. I mean, for other things, I doubt a lot. For this one, I'm totally sure. So every year, we have more hungry people, thanks to China, not in global terms, but without China, the number of hungry people in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Europe, in the United States, 40 million, 46 million food insecure people in the United States. Okay? Every year, we have more. And also, obesity and overweight is growing. I mean, it's expected, this is in the paper, that by 2030, there will be more than 2 billion overweight and obese people. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, why? Because the global food system, or the industrial food system, the commercial food system, basically wants to maximize profit. I mean, they don't want to maximize nutrition, public health, and the livelihoods of the producers. It's not in their nature. We have to accept it. I mean, I don't like pretty much criticizing the private sector, because, I mean, their nature, philosophically speaking, is maximizing profit, not maximizing the livelihoods of the people, not maximizing public health, not maximizing nutrition. That's the role of the state. And also, as Elinor Ostrom has clearly proven with natural resources, there is also a role for collective actions. So we eat badly, and the market is not helping us a lot. So that's why we have to think other things. I mean, and I've already stressed that in any case, I don't want to deny the market's role, and in the next 100 years, the market will stay there. And they have a role to fulfill. But we cannot let the market determine the type of food that we are going to eat? Or who is going to eat the food? That's one of my main criticisms. I mean, we cannot say that, well, you can eat as long as you have money to pay for that, to pay for the food. And that's the poverty approach. The poverty approach is that we need to raise the poverty level so everybody will have more money and everybody will have more access to food. Yeah, but I mean, if we raise the poverty level and everybody gets enough money, but then food rises as it's still doing, and the food price in general will keep on rising at a very steadily trend, well, it's like $5 in Geneva, $5 in Haiti. I mean, I will raise my purchasing power, but food price will rise. So at the end, it's always like this. The more we are in the world, the more difficult we'll get to get access to food. So that's why I think that basically, I mean, it's yet to be proven from the field research point of view, etc. But I think that more and more we are witnessing a creation of different civic food groups, the slow food movement, the different associations of consumers, producers, that they want to do things outside of the market rules. And the idea is that the state should promote more these type of groups, and the private sector should find a way of not combating these collective actions.
Okay. Are there any more burning questions out there? Or is it time to let José Luis rest?
There is one more burning question. Okay.
The last comment about poverty and food price. I think maybe if we define poverty with a food basket or going beyond like people's necessity approach, you know, which define poverty as the bundle of necessities of people, I think that reflects the price of food as well. So it is nothing like $5 in Swiss or something like that. So I think the broader approach to reduce poverty, which is related to development approach, is about provide people with enough resources to meet their needs. So it includes reducing hunger as well. So, you know, focusing on food can have kind of negative externalities rather than focusing on development, including poverty reduction. So I think
there's another hand going up in the back there. And then
for the very interesting presentation, my name is Vesla Monta, and I work for the International Rainwater Harvesting Alliance. It's a simple question. Do you consider water as food?
Water as?
As food.
Okay. I will start from the last one because it's easy. I mean, yes. And it was not more developed in the paper because I think that I couldn't cope with that much. But definitely, I mean, it could be included. Initially, I have already some writings on water as a common, but I think that it's more developed. The idea and the rationale for considering water as a common is more developed because water was almost fully considered as a common up to the 20th century. Now we are in the process of privatization, but there is a lot of theories and text that they defend that idea. And, well, I think that whatever rationale is applied here, it can also be applied to water. And then regarding the multidimensional poverty approach, I agree that, it could be too reductionist to think about just food, because we can neglect other dimensions and other aspects of wealth or social security or basic entitlements or basic needs. And I fully agree with Marta Sen's approach and this type of ideas. But in that case, I bring my practical approach. You know, I've been working in the field in different countries, in also in the capitals, in headquarters, etc. And I've seen that if we want to embrace a lot of things, at the end, we cannot swallow and we cannot cope with everything. And if we don't, if we are right now, today, if we are not even capable of getting rid of hunger, that is so easy because we produce enough, and it's only one, but the most, one of the most important dimensions of poverty and capabilities, etc. Because I can live for a while without a house, but I cannot live more than 3 days without drinking and 5 days without eating. So it's really, it's not a reductionist, and I'm not coming here from the food security point of view. You know that either you defend health, or you defend AIDS, or you defend poverty, or you defend food. Or so at the end, it's a sort of combat of different institutions with different mandates. No, but if you agree with me that there are four, if we forget about sunlight, there are only three essentials for our human bodies, our machineries, to keep on working. Food, water, and air. So, you know, food, especially the fundamental, the only economic and social and cultural right included in the covenant that is highlighted as fundamental is the fundamental right to be free from hunger. Because it's the only one that is extremely and closely associated to the right to life. This fundamental word has legal implications, and that's why what I defend is the minimum. I'm not saying that that's the only one. And it could be wonderful to have a minimum wage that equals not to the national food basket, but to the national minimum amount of money that will enable you to go to send your kids to school, to have enough clothes, to pay for the health insurance, etc. But at least let's try to cover the minimum. But at the minimum right now, nowadays, in this planet, is not covered for millions of people. So that's why, I mean, the idea is that that's not the only one. This I don't want to restrict all development approaches to food. But step by step, one by one, at least as we get rid of smallpox, and it doesn't necessarily mean that now there is a better health for everybody. No, but we get rid of smallpox, fine. So now let's get rid of hunger. And at the same time, more and more, because I was a hunger activist, but now more and more, I'm realizing that obesity and overweight, especially obesity, okay, because don't mix obesity with overweight. There are many people in this building that are really overweight. And that's not a big deal. And mixing, and that's the final statement, okay, because I think that we have to go, but mixing overweight with hunger and paralleling both problems, it's not a fair issue. You reach obesity by exerciting your will. You don't reach hunger by exerciting your will. And obesity is a different thing because it's really, I mean, I know that's a very conflicting issue, but, I think that it's not fair. They cannot be parallel. Obesity is really a disease. Overweight is not. But yes, in some developing countries, especially Central America, it's quite evident, but... But basically, that would be another...
The next seminar.
Yeah, the next seminar.
Okay, thank you very much. Just a couple of reminders. Well, first of all, thank you very much to José Luis. Enormously welcome presentation.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming and bringing your questions.
Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.